There are a lot of questions that are legitimate questions that come from the surprise of the unknown. And that's what we're really here for over these next couple of days. The two of us are going to be here over a three-week period, and we're going to be covering 10 topics in all. I'm Steve DeGruchy. I'm a student in theology. I've done all my studies, and I'm a conscientious objector as well. So I'm going home in August to do my alternative service, hopefully as a hospital chaplain. I'll let Marion introduce herself in a minute, but I just wanted to give you a feel for some of the things we'd be touching on. We're going to be looking at the overall political situation today. Then tomorrow I'm going to be speaking a bit more on the church in South Africa. Then Marion will be speaking on Black African Township life, or Black African life. Then the two of us are going to be talking about white involvement in the struggle against apartheid inside South Africa. And then Marion will be speaking about her job working in a squatter clinic. And with that, let me ask her to introduce herself.
Well, I'm Marion Loveday, and I've got a much more South African accent than Steve. So if any of you don't hear, please do ask me what I'm trying to say, and maybe I'll change the vocabulary, or maybe I'll just say it louder, or maybe Steve will interpret so that hopefully you'll understand what I am saying. I work in Cape Town in a squatter camp as a physical therapist with cerebral palsy. We're going to start off just by having a very brief look at, this is a very rough sketch of what the southern end of Africa looks like. And we just put this up here to give you sort of an idea of the major cities. I live and work in Cape Town. Steve will be returning to Cape Town. Johannesburg, which is a big industrial center of the country, is up here. That's where all the gold is mined. Pretoria, which is the, what do they call it, the legislative capital where a lot of the government work happens, is just about an hour north of Johannesburg. A big port here is Durban, which you also might have heard quite a lot about. Another major city in the Eastern Cape is Port Elizabeth. That's also quite often in the news because of the very strong black protest movement that's going on there at the moment. On the northwestern border, we have a border with Namibia, and I'm sure some of you know the controversy that continues to rage over the Namibia-Southwest Africa conflict. And then here we have Botswana and Zimbabwe and Mozambique over here. And this little dot is Lesotho, which is an independent country, but in fact hardly independent at all, very strictly controlled by South Africa. They just went in the beginning of last year and did what they wanted. They always are. And this is Swaziland, and the same sort of story applies there. And these dots over here are roughly marking out outlines, but they don't really. It's a bizarre system we've got of homelands in which black people are supposed to live in homelands. And the idea is that eventually they'll become independent, self-governing. But it's a bit of a joke. Right, so that's basically the geographical outline. So it's a peninsula. We've got 35 million people in South Africa. Of those, 5 million are white, 1.5 million are so-called colored, 500,000 are Indian, and 28 million are black. These areas outlined in dots represent 13% of the country. That is where 28 million black people are supposed to legally reside, in 13% of our land.
Okay, we're going to give you a bit of change of voices to make it a little bit more interesting. Up until the early 80s, the situation in South Africa was basically that the whites had the parliament and nobody had anything else. Everything else went through the Whites Parliament. Then when President Botha, who was then only a prime minister, came with his reform policy, you may have heard all about the reforms. His reform was to set up South Africa politically as it is now, and to divide Parliament into three houses, the House of Assembly, the House of Representatives, and the House of Delegates. The House of Assembly was for whites, that was the old Parliament. Then they created two new bodies, the House of Representatives for coloured people, and the House of Delegates for Indians. Then each one of those has elections amongst its own population group. Okay, so all the whites vote for representatives in the House of Assembly. All the coloureds vote for in the House of Representatives, and all the Indians in the House of Delegates. Then each of those has, we have the British West, well, hardly anymore, but it's supposed to be modelled on the British Westminster system, where you have, you vote a member of Parliament from a constituency. Are you familiar with that basic idea? Okay, it's different to the American Congress system. So that even if Marion and I are standing and 31 of you vote for me and 30 of you vote for Marion, I go into Parliament. And the fact that Marion got 49.9% of the vote is completely irrelevant to the fact that in Parliament I have 100% more votes than she has, not getting in. Okay, so it's a kind of winner-take-all idea in that sense. But each of the governing parties, this was the whole, Botha's whole idea, then is represented in what's known as the President's Council, with the formula 4-2-1. This is supposed to guarantee democracy in South Africa. But if you add 2 and 1 together, you'll notice something peculiar about it as against 4. That House of Representatives and Delegates, even if they combine, cannot outvote the House of Assembly on any issue. And the whole idea and the way that they put it across is that if there are areas of conflict, we will talk about it. And the common mind will reach consensus and there will be no need to vote on it. Well, the only two occasions that the House of Representatives and the House of Delegates have rejected stuff from the House of Assembly and it's gone to the President's Council, they've both been overridden within 24 hours. So the whole thing is set up to show the outside world that coloureds and Indians have the vote and we're all democratic and everybody can elect who they want. But it's the white system. It's pretty ingenious at that kind of level. The House of Representatives now, you have to try and work with this jumble thing. If you can get this, you've got South Africa. The trick is to get this, okay? Just to jump down here, within the parliamentary system, we're going to be talking a bit more about this. The governing or the majority party in the House of Representatives, the coloured party, is the Labour Party, which is down here. It's kind of... It grew out of a more, should we say, left-wing politics. But it opted to go into this new system, and that has kind of co-opted it completely into the system. The leader is a person called Alan Hendrickse, who was an ex-congregational minister, which is the denomination I'm from, but the church kicked him out because of his stand going into this. So the Labour Party, they hold, I think, about 97 of the 100 seats because everybody else boycotted the election. And they came into, I think it was a 7% vote of those who had registered to vote, which I think was only about 20% of the eligible voters. So it's a minute party. Some people got elected in with, I mean, that thing about 31-30 was a joke, but actually there was a person in Cape Town who was elected in on 33 votes to Parliament and a huge salary and all, you know, that kind of thing. The House of Delegates is split between two parties that have about equal strength, but they both are kind of irrelevant in South Africa. They're known as the Solid... The one that's generally on top is known as Solidarity. And it was formed about the time that Solidarity got going in Poland. It's kind of name borrowing, hoping to get some of the glory. And then we have the homeland system. The reason I put North there is slightly sarcastic. Because 421 kind of represents symbolically, I suppose, some of the demographic movement here. But this is where the whole system breaks down. The whole idea in the grand plan is that blacks would exercise their political rights in their specific homelands, where that's where they'd vote on a one-person, one-vote system for their leaders, because that's where they come from. Okay. But
they really didn't come from the homeland, did they? That's not their...
Yeah, what the situation is that these homelands are where the black tribes were found when the white trekkers were moving into the interior. And they're a kind of historical accident, that's where they were discovered. But I'm going to talk a bit more about this in the history thing. One of the ways that it was dealt with is that this is where God had put them. You know, where they were discovered is where God had put them. And that's where they should therefore exercise their right, you know, their...
But many of them have lived in other places for a long time.
Oh, yes, yeah. I'm going to get on with that now.
It's a funny situation of... still a lot of people come to urban areas from rural areas. So the people I work with, nearly all of them come from rural areas, and the children are all born in rural areas. But there's a very big split, and there are quite a large percentage in the more settled, older townships of people who actually were born in an urban environment, but it's the first generation only that's just been born there. Those people are about 30. The first time now.
So the question has become one of the big things on the agenda is, well, what happens to all those urban blacks who don't live in the homeland? Let alone, and we're not even going to really deal with this today, the fact that most of the homeland governments have come into power without a vote of the people in any way and have not had elections since, you know. I just wanted to deal with one other group that fits in this category but doesn't, is the group called Inkatha. The one major tribe, African tribe, is up here in the north of Zululand called the Zulu tribe. And the leader of whom is a person called Gatsha Buthelezi, that some of you may have heard. He's been kind of toted around by liberals as the future black leader of South Africa. I've stuck him out here on the far right of the political spectrum. Because I think that's where he rightly belongs. And I can explain that perhaps. I don't want to take up too much time, but his whole idea, he didn't opt for independence, so everybody thought he was very moral, and then discovered the reason he hadn't opted for his own little homeland is he hoped to become chief of the whole country. And he's developed a kind of neo-fascist organization. The closest historical parallel is with Mussolini's fascist movement in Italy, in terms of the political allegiances and the control of people. So, just before I stop here, and we're going to move on now to the parliament and the extra parliamentary groups, perhaps without going into any detail, are there any questions of clarification? It's a very confusing system, but... Anna? Okay. Yeah, these are the four racial categories that the government brought into play when it came to power in 1948. And they got them, some people say, from the fact that the Dutch Reformed Church had these four churches, white, colored, Indian, and black. Blacks, in the scheme of things, are people of tribal descent in South Africa. Indians are people from India. They're not Indians in the sense of Indians, say, in Latin America, or they're not indigenous people. They were brought as indentured servants. And coloureds are a group of mixed race, but also a very strong Malaysian population. The Dutch colonized South Africa at the same time that they were in the Dutch East Indies, Malaysia and that. And the slaves that they brought to South Africa were not the black African people, but in fact from their dark-skinned colonies to South Africa. So in fact, the Muslim population of South Africa is all within the colored community. To a large extent, yeah.
Yes, and the Chinese.
Yeah. Yeah, those are all the nuances. Thank you.
It's terrible to discuss South Africa like this. It feels terribly racist, but there's actually no other way to do it. You know, in progressive circles about 2 years ago, we talked about so-called whites and so-called coloreds and so-called Indians and so-called blacks, and we got so muddled up. We didn't know what food we were eating, you know. Do you take so-called white coffee or so-called black coffee? Didn't know what was going on. So just for the sake of clarity, we'll just actually use these blatant categories that the government has defined, because that's actually the lines along which South Africa works. Yes, Ruth. Now, we're going on to just discuss the latest election. I don't know if any of you have heard of the election that we had in South Africa on May the 6th. That was a whites-only election, so I was privileged enough to have the vote. It was an election called by President Botha, who is the ruler of the ruling Nationalist Party at the moment. I can't even remember. It was such a vague election. I remember an anti-apartheid sticker coming out, produced by one of the organizations. What's this general election about? Which general am I electing? There was sort of no issues, and one of the big issues for a lot of the extra parliamentary parties was that at the moment the country is completely governed by the military, by the police, by the army, and yes, it's which general, in fact, are we voting for? In the election, I'll give you some figures. 200,000 voted. 110,000 voted for the ruling Nationalist Party. 60,000 voted for the very conservative party. And what does that leave? 30,000 for the Progressive Party, which is a more liberal party. It actually means the Progressive Party were in official opposition, so they have actually lost their official opposition. So the official opposition is now an ultra-right party. Steve and I were trying to decide the percentage of people who didn't vote. We decided it must be around 2%. people who didn't vote because we refused to partake in a white-only election. Why should I have the vote when no other people had the vote? And although when you move in progressive circles, you tend to think everybody thinks like that, when you actually get out of that and think about it, you realize it's very, very small. So we think it's about 2% of the whole white population. No, didn't vote because they considered the election irrelevant. No.
Well, you've got to remember that only people over 18 have the vote, first of all. So you've already cut your population down to 2.5 million, let's say, because half the people are under 18. Then in the parliamentary system, if nobody's standing, then a candidate is elected unopposed. So a whole lot of people don't actually exercise their vote. Then a whole lot of people know that person X is going to win. So they're not actually going to go to the polling booth and bother to vote for that person. So you when you actually come down and count all the numbers, it's a pretty small amount of people who actually do vote. Hey, did we say 200,000? No, I'm going to check that up while Marion's speaking. You've just triggered something off in my mind.
But you're supposed to speak now. We're going to go on now to discuss, just in a little more detail, the parties that actually partook in this election. These were the parties in the House of Assembly, so the white-only parties. Steve was going to start with the Conservative Party, but I'll start with the Nationalist Party as he's busy there. Oh.
We dropped a nought off that. It was 2 million voted. Sorry, thank you. That's what comes from being outside the country. Where's the paper? Right. What we're going to do to give you a feel for the political parties that make up the South African situation and those outside of parliament, known as the extra parliamentary groups, is to give you a feel for the nuances. Okay, a lot of people perceive South Africa to simply be a black-white issue, without understanding that, yes, that is the basic conflict, but one of the reasons it's so difficult to make a move that seems so obvious is that, in fact, each of those groups is each of those spaces is occupied by a whole number of different groups. So we're going to start at the extreme right and then move to the center, and then from the center to the left, it's impossible to say who's more left than whom, but we know who's more right than whom because they actually pride themselves in that. On the extreme right, we have, and this actually isn't even the extreme right, but this is the Conservative Party. When this happened, the reform proposals from Botha, there were nationalists in the ruling party who said, no, this is going to give South Africa over to the communists. Okay, we must stick with the original nationalist plan, which means only whites have the vote. And so they broke away and formed the Conservative Party. The leader is a person called Andries Treurnicht, who is an ex-Dutch, well, he's probably still a Dutch Reformed Dominee, a minister in the Dutch Reformed Church. At the moment, as Marion said, they are now the official opposition. They have 21 seats in parliament out of about 170. Okay, and they're the second biggest party. They perceive themselves as being the true heirs of the whole Verwoerd, who was the architect of apartheid. They are sticking to it. It's these nationalists under Botha who are deviating, who are becoming reformist. A good example is Martin Luther at the time of the Reformation. He said, in order to be the true Catholic Church of the Creed, we must in fact break away from what is now the Catholic Church and go back to the founding fathers. You know, it's that kind of thing. And Treurnicht is saying, now, in order to be the true nationalists, we must break away from this heretic Botha and go back to the true spirit from which our nation comes. Its primary constituents, or the people who vote for it, are white working class and white farmers. So it finds its basis mainly in the rural areas. In fact, all of its 21 seats come from the Transvaal, this one province up here, which is the first time in South African history that an official opposition has been so regional. Its economic policies, we're going to try and give you sort of each, you know, category's leader, how many people, its constituency, its economic policies. It's pretty close to the Mussolini and Hitler idea of national socialism. In other words, the government must provide jobs and work for the people. So it's very funny to have them in the political spectrum on the right wing, because in fact, a lot of the economic policies are socialist, but national socialist, you know, where the government must provide jobs for white people, must look after its own. We are all part of the nation, we are all part of the folk. And in fact, the early Nationalist Party fought some of its elections before it came to power in tandem with the Communist Party of South Africa. It's one of the quirks of South Africa. But it's that whole socialist feel about Afrikaner nationalism. Its feelings, and we wanted to just try and give some category of it, is, and I've been using this kind of language, it's very tied into the whole mythology of the Afrikaner people in South Africa. People who came here, then the British came and got them. And they broke away from the British control and crossed the Red Sea and into the wilderness. And all the tribes of Canaan, godless people, attacked them, and still the British pursued them. And they finally got their own independent countries. And then they discovered gold, so the British took them over again. And then they developed guerrilla warfare. And they gave it to the world. And they fought, it was the first African independence movement, fought the Boer War. So you have to understand all that mythology that's there. And it gives a tremendous amount of emotional power to that party.
Yes, all.
Except for what's been happening more and more from Angola and Mozambique, Portuguese people have been coming into South Africa, fleeing from the Marxist countries, and they've in fact been very involved in right-wing politics. But the Conservative Party is Afrikaans speaking, so unless you can speak Afrikaans, it's very difficult to get in. I mean, it's very difficult to participate in it.
Then the next party along this line is the ruling Nationalist Party. The Nationalists have been in power since 1948. They've just been re-elected with 132 seats. It's 132 out of 175. The leader is President Botha. He rules in conjunction with something which we didn't mention here because it's actually sort of an unmentionable. It's called the President's Council. Five or six people he chooses sit with him from his party, and they make the decisions that affect the country. And as you noticed, this ominous naught here, black people, 28 million of them, forgotten about. They're not forgotten about. They've got one white person who discusses for them on the President's Council on their behalf. That's how they are coped with. The politics at the moment are confused. It's a party under stress. For the last election, the slogan was reform, not surrender. This was the reform, this making of this complex parliamentary system. But what has resulted is the fact that it's now got these fragmentations off to the right, the Conservative Party, and just this year, to the left, a couple of independents. I don't know if you heard of Dennis Worrell, who was the government's ambassador to London, who split off, and there was much excitement about him, and people said, oh, wonderful, in this election, we're actually going to have there's going to be a swing to the left in the Nationalist Party, and people are actually starting to think more liberally. There was a wonderful cartoon. Then a lot of academics in the actual Nationalist Party itself withdrew from the Nationalist Party and joined the independents, saying this reform is a sham. It's not real reform. We've got to move. And they also joined the independents. And there was this wonderful cartoon in the Cape Times of this great big, like, bull-like Afrikaner man sitting there, and his brain was running down his sleeve with Afrikaner independence written all over it, symbolizing the sort of that the intellectuals have actually are actually leaving the party. They don't believe in this reform any longer. Economically, so the leader is President Botha. Economically, it's a free market system at the moment. As Steve was saying, this unique thing of a lot of the country is actually controlled by the government. So the railways are state-owned. The telephones, the airlines, all that kind of thing is state-owned. And we have the wonderful ratio of one civil servant to 19 people. Whereas in Britain, it's one civil servant to 49,000 people. At the moment, they're on a bid to increase their powers. And the state of emergency, which was imposed a year ago, June the 10th last year, has just been reimposed with stricter measures. The people who support them it was the Afrikaner intellectuals. I think most of them are left. And the businessmen, and the Afrikaans and English middle class.
Yes, they became the official opposition. Yeah. Okay, then, to the left of the Nationalists are what are known as the Progressive Federal Party. They're they were the official opposition and they lost seats in this election. Everybody hoped that they would become a government in waiting. This was their big slogan, and in fact they became even less than the official opposition. Their basic constituency is the white business class, and white students, white intellectuals, white professionals. They used to get some support from the white middle class, but since the reform, they've kind of all shifted across to the nationalists. Where they've been perhaps the strongest has been in opposing the state of emergency and the apartheid system from within parliament. But they've had to kind of become always talking on behalf of blacks. You know, they're in parliament on behalf of blacks. So it's very difficult to go and fight an election when you're representing people who can't vote you. And that's in fact what's happening. The more they speak on behalf of blacks, the more whites actually leave them. So you have this whole dichotomy of whites electing representatives to not represent them. It's kind of democracy in a weird way. And they've been very opposed to the state of emergency. Two of the figures you may know is the leader, Colin Eglin, and one of the stalwarts, a person called Helen Suzman. She's a name that sometimes is going around. Their economic policy is also free market, capitalist. When you hear of people who oppose sanctions but also oppose apartheid, it's mainly this group. Okay, because they are actually all the executives in Mobil and Shell in South Africa. So it gets a bit complicated for them. I think they figure out it's difficult to know whether it's going to hurt blacks or them more. But anyway, capitalism is where it's at here. So their position they're against sanctions, but also against apartheid. Okay, I just wanted to speak very simply and quickly about two groups to the left and outside parliament, but that are made up of whites, really. The one is the Black Sash, which is a group of white women, and that's been going since 1948, and is becoming progressively more radical. It used to be the sort of housewives of the businessmen kind of thing, but it's now become the housewives of the businessmen, but who probably don't talk politics to their husbands anymore because they've been accepted into the black community, and that distances them from the sham that's going on around them. And then two very important people in the Progressive Federal Party, the leader, Frederick van Zyl Slabbert, and the chief ideologue, Alex Borain, both walked out of parliament at the beginning of last year, said this whole thing's a complete sham, and formed an organization called the Institute for Democratic South Africa, IDASA. And we just wanted to include that there, that within the white community and made up of the white constituency, there is shifts outside of parliament. Before we now move into the real spectrum of extra-parliamentary politics, we've gone on a little bit, but we kind of feel it's important to get this all down. If that's okay with you, if we can just keep moving.
Now, just going to explain this grid a little bit, because extra-parliamentary opposition in South Africa is not a simple affair. Because first of all, we've got parties and organizations in exile. And under that, we've named it external. We've got the ANC and the PAC, the African National Congress and the Pan-African Congress. Internally in the country, we've also got extra-parliamentary parties opposed to apartheid, the United Democratic Front, UDF, and BPC, the Black People's Congress. And then just here, we also wanted to mention trade unions, because that's actually becoming an increasing factor in our history at the moment. First of all, I was going to explain that now. First of all, just going to talk a bit about the African National Congress. I'm sure most of you have heard about that. The leaders, the external leader, Oliver Tambo, who's very highly respected inside the country as well. And in fact, the real leader, the person who's the figure of all resistance in South Africa, Mandela, and his wife, Winnie Mandela. The African National Congress is a charterist organization. And we've put charterist here, the COSATU, the UDF, and the ANC are all charterist organizations, and we're just going to read you a few brief lines of the Freedom Charter, which is what these organizations espouse towards. And it's our most important document, really. In any rally you go to, you will have the Freedom Charter or bits of it read or sung or poetry done to or something like that. The Freedom Charter. We, the people of South Africa, declare for all our country and the world to know that the people shall govern. All national groups shall have equal rights. The people shall share in the country's wealth. The land shall be shared among those who work it. All shall be equal before the law. All shall enjoy equal human rights. There shall be work and security. The doors of learning and culture shall be opened. There shall be houses, security and comfort. There shall be peace and friendship. These freedoms we will fight for, side by side, throughout our lives, until we have won our liberty. Now, you can hear from that it's actually quite a diffuse document, and it's actually quite an umbrella, because the Chartist organizations are very open and actually want to draw in as many people as possible. So, in the African National Congress itself, it has communist links on the one hand, but there's also quite an association at the moment with the businessmen of South Africa. So it's not as if it's a very clear, defined economic policy at the moment. It's a question of we have to be strategic. We want to actually get out the apartheid government in South Africa, and we want to be as broad a front as possible until we get there. So the economic policy of the ANC, yes, they have links with the South African Communist Party, which was banned also in 1961, as was the ANC. But it also has other links, on the other hand, with people who aren't communist. ANC was formed in 1912. It remained a non-military organization until 1963, when it took developed an armed wing, which is known as Mkhonto weZizwe. It was banned in 1961, and in 1963, Mandela and other famous leaders were put in prison. It continues to exist in exile, as you all know. And the bizarre thing is that you can't pick up a South African paper at the moment without reading ANC and headlines that big on every front page. It's become, I don't know how to describe it. It, because it's banned, it's talked about all the time.
Okay, so the one category that cuts across trade unions, internal and external organizations, is the charterist. And the other category is known as the Africanist or the black consciousness. The Freedom Charter was adopted by a number of organizations: the African National Congress, the Indian Congress, the Colored People's Congress, and the Congress of Democrats, which was the white group. So it's known as a non-racial document. And all of these organizations, COSATU, UDF, and ANC, are non-racial, both in terms of present policy and in terms of future goal. The Africanist and the black consciousness movements felt that whenever whites get involved, which is actually true, they shipwreck the whole thing. They start introducing their own petty bourgeois politics and all that kind of stuff. And the history of that in South Africa is, I mean, it's true to a large extent. What's happened now is that whites have got involved in these under black leadership. That's what's kind of solved the problem. But still, the earliest breakaway was in 1960 when the PAC broke from the ANC. Ostensibly, actually, over the ANC's involvement with the Communist Party, which was predominantly white. And the PAC felt that what was important, the Pan-African Congress, this was just at the time of independence in Africa, if you think of 1960. I mean, it's the Organization of African Unity was being talked about, whether African states should become Pan-African like the United States of America. It was a whole attempt to ground South Africa in Africa. At the moment, they have representation in the United Nations. They're not very strong, and they're not talked about very much in South Africa. They have a military wing, POKO, P-O-Q-O, but you don't hear very much about it. But they're certainly there. And in fact, Sharpeville, those of you who may know something about South Africa, the whole PASS campaign, PASS law campaign, that triggered off Sharpeville was organized by the PAC, not the ANC. So you've got this very basic split that covers both organizations in exile, internal organizations, and even the trade unions.
Then internally, in 1983, was launched the United Democratic Front, also a Chartist organization. It was actually launched after a call by Busak, Alan Busak, in response to 83 was the formulation of this weird and wonderful parliament which we were going to have. So it was actually launched as an anti-constitution. I remember going to endless meetings about the anti-constitution and anti-Kuhnhof bills, because Kuhnhof was involved in all this architecture. And it was a call for a front of organizations to oppose the apartheid system. And that's what it is. It was when it was launched, it was a front of over 600 organizations linking them together. And they sort of felt that if they could have a front of organizations, it's so much more difficult to ban than if you just have a single organization. Because how can you go about banning 600 organizations? There's no real leader in the UDF. We just put down here a couple of the patrons who you might have heard of, and mostly church people. Busak, Frank Chikane, Sisulu, Albertina Sisulu, and Mandela, both Winnie Mandela and her husband. The government says UDF is just internal ANC, and to some, to all intents and purposes, yes, they're quite right. It's been very hard hit by the repression that's existing at the moment. It's actually the UDF more than anybody else that's been, the leaders have been persecuted and in detention. At one stage last year, the executive were all in detention. They put up a shadow executive. Within 2 weeks, they were all in detention, and then everybody else just had to muddle along. It's supported to a large extent by the black population, who are very excited about it. In Durban, there's enormous problems with Inkatha. And I don't know if you've read anything about the black-on-black violence. The government always says, oh, yes, this is black-on-black violence. It's actually very much more complex than that, and it's tended to be Inkatha versus UDF. Because in Durban, the UDF has attracted the Indian population and has failed to gain much of a stronghold because of Buthelezi and his Inkatha policy in Durban itself. It's got a lot of support in the Eastern Cape and a lot of support in the Transvaal. And over the time of the election, there was still such a lot of feeling in the Transvaal that a boycott was called. It was a 90% stay away on election day. It was a 90% stay away of black workers, called by the UDF in Kasatu.
Okay, then representing the Africanist or black consciousness now more in South Africa internally is a group known as the ZAPO, or a front of organizations that they're part of called the National Forum, but a ZAPO gives most of the leadership. They are the kind of spiritual heirs of Steve Biko. Does that name ring any bells with you? He founded the Black People's Convention. That was banned in 77. Marion got it a little bit wrong, because the ZAPO and the National Forum are now really in the forefront. Although many of Biko's friends and associates are in fact in the UDF, they kind of feel that black consciousness was important at that time to actually assert black leadership. And now that that's been accepted in the UDF, there's nothing wrong with having whites working in the organization. Black consciousness carries on in these organizations. One of the ways of telling most of the black consciousness movements is that they use the word Azania for South Africa. just as Rhodesia became Zimbabwe and something became Zaire, what was it before? The Congo became Zaire. You know, there are all those movements after independence. The idea was to call South Africa a Zania. So anything where you see AZ or AZ, as you call it, on in South African politics, you can be pretty assured that it's black consciousness to become a Zania. They're quite strong in the Transvaal and are spattering around the place, but they are much, much weaker than the United Democratic Front. You need to understand that the ANC organized and has roots to 1912. It's the oldest political party on the African continent. The PAC only began in 1960 and was banned within 9 months, 1961. So it doesn't have that kind of roots. Black consciousness thrived for a while, but then Biko was killed and the black consciousness movements were banned. So it really hasn't ever been penetrated into the soil. Okay.
And then we just wanted to mention the trade unions. COSATU was launched the beginning of this year. That's the Congress of South African Trade Unions. Is very much considers itself the workerist side of the UDF, and they've made very strong links with the UDF at the moment. They're claiming a membership of 2 million. A large proportion of that is the mine workers who are working under the NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers. We've had considerable strikes this year. And I don't know if you've heard of also the South African Transport Service workers. 20 of them were killed in May this year. They're also members of COSATU, which is a charterist trade union.
Okay, well, just very briefly, on the African or the black consciousness wing, NACTU, National Council of Trade Unions, is the attempt to draw together trade unions under that auspices. INCATA has a trade union called UWSA, I think, United Workers Union of South Africa. And that's an attempt. It's the only trade union I've ever come across that believes wholeheartedly in the capitalist system. You know, normally trade unions have got some rhetoric about, especially in third world countries, about changing this into socialism. And it's the only trade union that has business executives as its union leadership, because it was launched by INCATA to counter these trade unions. So it was launched on May the 1st last year. At a big rally, and all the Zulu people who belong to INCATA are supposed to become representatives of it there. We just finally wanted to finish off where I'm going to pick up tomorrow, and that's the churches. And I've kind of put it going all the way from the left to the right, because the churches in South Africa span the whole bang shoot. I'm not going to say anything more than that, but just that you'll notice there's some church from Andreas Trinicht, who's a Dutch Reformed minister, through to Alex Berain, who was a Methodist minister and has now moved here, through to some of the leadership. Oliver Tambo, for example, is a practicing Christian. Alan Busak is a minister. Frank Shikani is now, in fact, the head of the South African Council of Churches. And, of course, the bulk of African population in South Africa is Christian. So the churches really go all the way right across. Well... That's about it. We put Tutu in between. Tutu is both a signatory to the UDF and the Freedom Charter side of things, and he's also part of the National Forum. He kind of straddles in between, although I notice from his more recent pronouncements he speaks more about the UDF and COSATU and the ANC. So I don't know what exactly the situation is, but I know he signed or has his name in both those two. He kind of straddles those two. I think we need to take some questions. up until a few years ago, and Namibia, which is known in South African government language as Southwest Africa, had 5 seats to the South African Parliament. I think that was till about 1977. And then they instituted this whole thing, I think about the same time that Sadat and Begin and all that were getting together in Egypt, and peace was in the air, you know, Jimmy Carter and all that. And so they had their big thing here in Namibia and they sorted it out. But SWAPO refused to get involved in that, the Southwest African People's Organization. So it's supposed to, South Africa considers it a free country, independent with its own elections, but it's like a homeland. It's controlled by South Africa. I mean, South African troops are right up here into, this is the border with Angola. South African troops are right over here. The whole thing is a militarized zone for South Africa. And in fact, one of the real cries of the far right is, you give away Namibia. It's the domino theory, you know. If Namibia falls, we go. So the moment you give independence to Namibia, we can call out the people and shoot you. I mean, I don't know what the far right will do. Probably shoot somebody. But it's such a fear that will seem like a weak will on behalf of the government that it's so involved in South African politics in that sense. They were a white person who simply probably has good relationships with his farm laborer and can speak the language. So, I mean, this is the way politics goes on in South Africa. Oh, yes, he'd be a member of parliament and he'll be, a local farmer who's been elected to parliament. Everybody knows he plays rugby with his servants, so he can speak the language. So he's the amiable kind of guy who knows his blacks, you know. And we'll go into it. The whole idea recently is to get in the urban areas a whole thing called community councillors going, whereby the blacks are supposed to elect their community councillors, who then are part of a broader think tank that the whites can influence to get their ideas. But blacks have boycotted the elections and burnt down the homes of the community councillors and assassinated some of them, as a kind of show of disgust that people would do that. So it really is a white attempt to control black politics. And it's this constant, I mean, I think the formula 4-2-1 sums it all up. You know, we give you, but we don't give you enough. As Marion said, reform but not surrender. Well, I mean, you know, you're playing with that all the time. You give and you take. And I think that's the way that the government perceives. If you can give and take in a boxing arena in which troops are stationed all around the arena so nobody can change the rules. I think that's the way they perceive the South African situation happening. There's been a kind of unquestioned stance of pro-sanctions. Even from 1961, Mandela called for sanctions, so it goes back a long way. Maybe if it had been heeded then, you know, things would have happened. But most of these organizations are pro-sanctions and divestment, but they haven't really worked it through with their constituencies. It's very difficult for the ANC, for example, to have a poll. Are our voters in favor of sanctions? Or for the UDF to say, let's ask everybody. So it's pretty much the intellectuals and the leadership seeing that this is what should happen, whereas the grassroots might, in fact, not necessarily agree with that. That's part of the tension, yeah.
Effect two. I think the thought is that pressure from any side will cause the South African government to collapse. If we can ruin them economically, the collapse will be sooner. And it was very effective, like with oil sanctions. I think the slight uneasiness at the moment comes with the fact that who are the actual people who suffer when you call for sanctions? It's actually the black working class who then become unemployed. And it's sort of coping with that sort of conflict, which is the problem at the moment. Everybody knows that we actually want that economic pressure and we want the South African government to collapse as soon as possible.
It's just that the biting edge is it's that black man who was working for Shell. He's lost his job, and now that family's on the starvation line. Yeah.
Thought maybe just to finish it off, we've done a pretty much an analysis here without giving very much. I mean, obviously our own perspectives are in the way we've set it up, but we just perhaps wanted a minute each just to say where we see things going. I think for me the issue, what this election has kind of clarified, is that the big issue in South Africa now is, do we talk to the ANC or not? For blacks, the issue is a non-issue. I mean, the ANC is the leadership. It's the white parties are basically split on that issue. Do we talk to the ANC or not? Now, just as we were sitting here, this Christian Science Monitor from Friday, June the 12th, okay, that's Friday, came. And I want to read you something which I think stands. It says, this is after the election, okay, whites are feeling very strong. Now they're going to talk to blacks. So they say, in an interview Thursday, Stoffel van der Merwe, who's this guy who's going to do it, vowed to enter talks without any non-negotiable preconditions. He said this applied even to Pretoria's view that any group must be based on ethnically defined group rights. Okay, so there's absolutely no preconditions. Then the second paragraph says, although he echoed President Pieter Botha's bar on including the outlawed African National Congress in the process, Mr. van der Merwe said ANC sympathizers would be welcome if they disassociated themselves from the ANC's aim to use violence to overthrow the present system. Now listen, this is the convoluted logic. Even people that were involved in violence, if they are not ideologically committed to violence, they are the kind of people one can persuade. If we can show them that there is another, I mean, this is the white guy talking to his black laborers. If we can show them that there is another way to reach their political aspirations, they can be weaned away. And so this is, you know, we must talk to the legitimate leaders, but we can't talk to the ANC because they espouse violence. So the situation gets worse and our military budget goes up and we kill more people, but we're not ideologically committed to violence. They are, but we can't talk to them. But everybody else we talk to is a complete puppet and nobody listens to them. But we can't talk to the ANC, but we know we must. So let's kill more people. But it's that kind of game. And until you get to the point where they will say, there are no preconditions, we'll talk. There are no preconditions, but anybody who espouses violence, you know, it's that kind of rubbish. So I think for me, that is the big issue in South African politics now, is that no matter how strong the Nationalist Party can be, no matter how powerful whites feel now, if you can't talk to the ANC, well, you know, I think we're in for a kind of Beirut situation. Sorry, can Marion just finish?
I think it's even worse than that. I think that for the majority of the black population, they've decided that violence is inevitable. And the only way to overthrow this government is violence. I think this last election shows us that there's no ways that whites are going to reform, that they're going to swing right, that they're going to defend themselves. And I think we're in for a very bloody future. And a few years ago, some of us thought, maybe 5 years, there'll be freedom. Most people are saying now, maybe 20. We hope there'll be freedom.
The question is the involvement of communists in the ANC. The South African Communist Party is a party in its own right. It's banned. The ANC is a party in its own right, and it's banned. There's been a lot of cooperation between the two, and a large number of the people on the ANC committee, I mean leadership, belong to the SACP as well, South African Communist Party. The situation, as far as I can tell, is analogous to America joining with the communists to fight Hitler. Basically, when you look at the track record, the communists are the good guys, are part of the goodies in South Africa. Regardless of other issues, the point is now, you're fighting a common enemy, you're fighting your Hitler, you want to open up two fronts, you're on this side, Stalin's on the other side, you're going to make your alliance. I mean, you're playing war. you know, you're fighting war. So I think that's part of it, the strategic involvement of communists. And I think the question of the track record is important too. In South Africa, communists have always been on the right side. Not always. In fact, the Communist Party is very embarrassed about the fact in 1920 it had a slogan, "Win South Africa for the white working class." This is when it actually cooperated with the nationalists at that time. But then it was corrected at, I think, the Sixth International of the Communist Party. But I think you've got one of the things to understand about South Africa is that's what people go by, the track record.